My guest at this time is David Gardenstein-Ross. He's director of the Center for the Study of Terrorist Radicalization at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies here in Washington. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, due in September, entitled Why Al-Qaeda is Winning. We want to get his thoughts on some of the most important questions in the aftermath of the killing of Osama bin Laden, as well as how some folks here in America are reacting to the latest developments. And David, it's always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Greg. It's always great to join you.
We'll certainly wait till September to talk about the intriguing premise of your book, why you say Al-Qaeda is winning. But let's talk about one of those potential factors, and that's the issue that of Pakistani loyalty to the United States mission here. How much has the fact that much of the government has been helping us and some of it has not over the past 10 years factoring into our ongoing challenges with Al-Qaeda?
It's a great challenge, not just with Al-Qaeda, but also a great challenge with respect to the counterinsurgency that we're currently trying to wage in Afghanistan against the Taliban insurgency. The ISI, Pakistan's Military Intelligence Service, has been quite heavily supporting insurgents. One of the key questions that you get into, and something that has provided for some of our official hesitation, is at what level is this support coming? Is it official policy? Is it unofficial policy, such as rogue agents or wink and a nod support? Or is it the complex of retired generals and contractors who maintain quite a bit of influence within Pakistan's ISI? In addition to that, I think one of the reasons why we emphasize that uncertainty on a public level is because it's very difficult to formulate policy with respect to what we do about that. It's difficult to acknowledge that an organization like ISI has American blood on its hands, which it definitely does, without having a strategy to respond to that. The problem, of course, is that our supply routes are completely dependent upon Pakistan, that Pakistan has been giving us permission to carry out drone strikes against top Al-Qaeda leaders. And this is something that makes us hesitant to do a 180 with respect to our Pakistan policy.
And so when we hear folks like the prime minister adamantly deny that they were complicit in any way, is it distinctly possible that much of the government is actually telling the truth when they say that and they don't necessarily know what some of the others, the more nefarious, the ISIs are doing?
I think it's a little bit different than that. I think of all people, the president and the prime minister are most aware of this because they have to deal in a system where there's not complete loyalty to them. If you look back at the Pervez Musharraf years, he was the military dictator of Pakistan and someone who, if anybody would have had much more unity within his government because he controlled both the military and also the civilian government at the same time. He had a number of assassination attempts that were aimed at him. The official count is something like 3 or 4. By my count, there were something like 7 to 9 different assassination attempts aimed at him, and many of them were quite evidently inside jobs. For example, in a couple-week period, he drove over a bridge twice. And the bridge blew up within a few minutes of his convoy going over, which means that the people who were trying to kill him had advance notice of which route he was going to take and the approximate time that he would be going over this particular bridge. The fact that there were inside attempts to kill Musharraf is demonstrative of the lack of unity of government. When you're the prime minister of a country, though, you're not going to get up on the world stage and say, I don't control my own military, or I don't control factions within my military. Moreover, you're not going to get up and admit to some level of governmental complicity. So I understand why they're saying what they're saying. It's a tough job for Pakistan's civilian government. Among other things, they're basically expatriates within their own country.
David, you mentioned a moment ago that we're probably not going to do a wholesale 180 on our policy with Pakistan. So what do you expect, and what's the most effective way of trying to root out the double cross we're getting from certain sectors of the government?
It's a very difficult question. I'm not going to say that there's a clear path ahead because we've been working at it for the past decade, and we have not come up with a coherent policy. A lot of times when people are on the radio, they'll make it as though everything is so very easy and they have a clear path forward that would solve all the problems. I'm not going to pretend that we have such a thing, but I will say we have to do better than we've done because what we've had is utter policy incoherence for the past decade since the 9/11 attacks.
David, obviously, in the wake of the bin Laden killing, just in the past few days, in fact, we've had 3 airline incidents. We uncovered at least some evidence at the bin Laden compound that there was a plan to target trains in the U.S., and so you have folks calling for a no-ride list, like Chuck Schumer on Amtrak and so forth. Do you get the sense that some of this is just overreaction to the possibility of retaliation on the part of al-Qaeda? Do you get the sense that these are real issues that need attention that haven't gotten attention until now? How do you read some of the concern over some of these incidents in the last week or so?
Oh, well, these are real issues. I mean, the incidents in flight, the one in which the man carrying a Yemeni passport shouted Allahu Akbar and charged the pilot, that's a concerning incident. He was ultimately restrained. But that's not just paranoia. When someone does that, obviously you should be concerned. Likewise, the plot that we uncovered, and we don't know what stage of operation it was in. It could well have been aspirational, which was targeting trains. That's also something we should take very seriously, because one thing al-Qaeda has shown throughout its history is a desire to target mass transit. And the reason why is quite obvious, that it's economically vital to the Western countries that they're opposing. And they're key choke points where you can really drive up the cost to the enemy by attacking them. Even though aviation has been very well guarded over the past decade, al-Qaeda has continued to be able to find vulnerabilities within our aviation security, from Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab and his underpants bomb to the more recent plot where they got PETN-based bombs in ink cartridges aboard UPS and FedEx planes. All of these are targeting very key choke points of ours, and likewise, rail travel. That's another key choke point.
And obviously anyone who's traveled Amtrak knows that the security there is pretty limited, if it's there at all, depending on where you depart from. Is there a need for tighter security in that situation? What do you think is on the horizon?
Well, the main thing that we need to do societally is we need to have a much more adaptive system of security. Right now, our security is very predictable on Amtrak and elsewhere, where, aviation security is very intrusive, but you know what you're going to get when you go through, which creates very static defenses. We have some limited behavioral profiling, but it's not really done in any robust manner. On Amtrak, you know, when we're talking about security, if we tried to replicate airplanes, just imagine how awful that would be for people who were trying to travel on Amtrak. I mean, are we suddenly going to have security checkpoints outside every terminal in which you have to go through and take your shoes off and put your computer through a scanner? Is that what's going to happen on Amtrak? I mean, the key thing that we need to be able to do is move away from this very static, predictable, and intrusive kind of security system that we've had, and move towards a system of trying to identify the terrorists themselves using such techniques as behavioral detection and other kinds of profiling that will allow us to channel risks on the right people. Otherwise, what we'll end up with is a very intrusive and very expensive system, which is precisely the system that al-Qaeda wants us to have because of the overall cost that it imposes throughout society.
And one that a lot of folks say is not very effective either, given what has gotten through at certain times. So, David, very interesting. Thank you for your time. We look forward to talking to you about your book in a few months.
My pleasure.
David Gardenstein-Ross is director of the Center for the Study of Terrorist Radicalization at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Again, coming in September, his new book, Why Al-Qaeda is Winning.